and even psychologically far more critical than acquiring British Singapore. Corregidor, Fort Mills, was the largest and most important of the four small islands that the Americans had fortified, along with Forts Drum, Hughes, and Frank, to guard the entrance to the vast Manila Bay and to ensure veritable administrative control of the entire Philippine archipelago. On the eve of the Pearl Harbor attacks, the American general in charge of the Philippines, the legendary Douglas MacArthur, had marshaled about 70,000 troops, including some 25,000 Americans. The bulk of his forces were stationed on the island of Luzon, ringed around the Philippine capital at Manila. Unlike Malaya, the Philippines had already been granted a transition to independence, and the Americans had little experience as a colonial power. The result was a closer relationship between native forces and foreign occupiers. Unlike Singapore's defenses, MacArthur's air arm was more formidable, with some 107 newer model P-40 fighters and 35 B-17 bombers, as well as additional but admittedly obsolete aircraft. But MacArthur also assumed that his more forward forces might be hit in any future war well before the American fleet at Pearl Harbor was endangered, and thus could be resupplied from Hawaii. The brilliance of the Japanese Pearl Harbor attack was in first striking the supposedly safest of American Pacific bases and the nerve and supply center for the more exposed outposts of U.S. naval and land power. On the first day of the war, Major General Lewis Brereton's air forces in the Philippines were caught on the ground. 18 B-17s, 51% of his force, and 63 P-40s, 59%, were destroyed, nearly wrecking American air effectiveness before the siege had even begun. By mid-December 1941, due to constant aerial combat and evacuations of the remaining bombers to Australia, the Americans had little else but antiquated P-35 fighters. The same story proved true of the Philippines' naval forces. Japanese bombing quickly took out most of the supplies and often defective torpedoes essential for the effectiveness of the island's 29 submarines, which were quickly redeployed to Australia. After the initial Japanese landing on December 22nd, north of Manila, the 43,000-man army of General Masaharu Homma, executed by firing squad for war crimes after the war rather than hanged, as was General Yamashita, the conqueror of Singapore, quickly captured Manila. In such a worst-case scenario, the Americans had counted on a rugged fighting retreat through the Bataan Peninsula and the denial of all entry into Manila Bay. In the unfortunate words of an initially overconfident General MacArthur that would haunt him later, "Homma may have the bottle, but I have the cork." In fact, MacArthur was inside the bottle, and Homma had the stopper. For a short siege, Corregidor, the rock, was almost invincible. Its mere 1,735 acres bristled with 56 heavy artillery weapons, anchored by two 12-inch guns that could hit approaching ships at a 17-mile distance with 900-pound projectiles. Even more impressive were 12-inch mortars in sunken pits that had greater utility against enemies on the mainland. The other smaller island fortresses were likewise protected by massive reinforced concrete bunkers, and in the case of Fort Drum, even larger 14-inch guns. Such ossified weapons, however, were hardly effective in a new age of air power, mechanized assault, and mobile batteries. Instead, as was true of Singapore, the American big guns reflected the defensive and often colonial mentality of a distant and bygone age. The usual turn-of-the-century threats to colonial outposts were the dreadnoughts of other Western fleets, and not overland attacks by Asian ground troops. Even before evacuations from Bataan, there were over 5,000 troops manning the fortress. Corregidor was a veritable rock with a 60-mile labyrinth of underground tunnels and an array of interconnected passages and roads, and even a 20-mile electric trolley line. Lateral passages were stocked with food, ammunition, and gasoline. But, like the British defenses at Singapore that had fallen just weeks earlier, the nature and deployment of Corregidor's four-decade-old batteries were ill-suited against shelling and bombing, or against invasion launched from its rear on the Philippine mainland. There were other problems also similar to Singapore's. While the larger batteries were ample, most of their ammunition was armor-piercing shells intended to shred warships, not dug-in infantry. And the typically flatter trajectories of many of the bigger guns were not as suitable for hitting nearby land targets. Corregidor had never been fully fortified and armed in anticipation of air attack. The two largest guns, for example, were still exposed on concrete pads and appeared from the air as veritable shooting targets. Corregidor was the land version of hugely impressive but largely irrelevant battleships such as the Bismarck, Tirpitz, Musashi, and Yamato. Unlike conditions at Malta, there were not to be friendly fleets, much less convoys, anywhere in the surrounding Philippine seas to resupply the bastion for an extended defense. Any rare attempts at supplying Corregidor by sea usually failed to pierce the Japanese naval blockade. Pearl Harbor was over 5,000 miles distant and still in shock from the December 7th attacks. By January 1942, the Japanese enjoyed de facto air and naval superiority over most of the Pacific west of Hawaii. Inflicting some 20,000 Japanese casualties after 4 months of fighting may have justified the Americans' dogged defense. Yet had Corregidor survived longer, there was still no immediate likelihood that American naval, air, and land forces would have broken through to save the islands. That task would require 3 more years of American preparation and overwhelming air and naval supremacy. The Philippines were so deeply embedded in the American psyche, partly from the habit of playing the neocolonial occupier after the post-Spanish-American insurrection, partly due to a costly put-down of Philippine insurrections, partly in self-congratulatory pride from shepherding the Philippines to its promised independence, that both its defense and later liberation transcended strict military logic. At the beginning of the war, Dwight Eisenhower, who had served as an assistant military liaison to the Philippines under General Douglas MacArthur, remarked of the U.S. obligations to the Philippines, "In spite of difficulties, risks, and fierce competition for every asset we had, a great nation such as ours, no matter how unprepared for war, could not afford cold-bloodedly to turn its back on our Filipino wards and the many thousand Americans, troops, and civilians in the Filipino archipelago. We had to do whatever was remotely possible for the hapless islands, particularly by air support and by providing vital supplies." Once Bataan fell, Corregidor's population swelled from 9,000 to over 14,000. It was almost impossible to feed the large number of non-combatant civilians. The fortress's tiny earthen runway was too small and exposed for reliable airlifts, even if there had been relief from the nearby Philippine islands not yet occupied by the Japanese. When the fortress fell on May 4th and 5th, 1942, after a veritable 4-month siege, over 11,000 captives were dispersed to Japanese prison camps all over Asia and to the Japanese mainland. Somewhere around 1,000 of the defenders were killed and another 1,000 wounded. Corregidor, like Singapore, accurately reflected the larger truth about the sieges of World War II. British, American, and Italian forces more often surrendered their positions rather than face annihilation. In contrast, Japanese and Russian defenders, often Germans as well, were more likely to resist to the end. No side had a reputation for a particular mastery of siegecraft in the manner of the Athenians during the age of Pericles, the Imperial Romans, or the Ottomans. Instead, brute force, not art, determined whether a fortress held out or fell, and the side with the most bombs, shells, guns, and soldiers, and the will to use them without worry over civilian casualties, usually won. Sieges, like all other modes of war, were also mirrors of the ebb and flow of the World War II battlefield. After 1943, the Axis did not conduct a single major successful siege, in contrast to a prior record of successes at Corregidor, Singapore, Sevastopol, and Tobruk. Why Singapore and Corregidor fell while Malta survived is not explained entirely by the pre-war neglect of these fortresses' defenses, given that Malta was poorly garrisoned through much of 1939 and 1940. That said, its greater proximity to Britain allowed eventual reinforcements impossible in the Pacific, where the Japanese fleet posed a far greater comparative threat than the Italian in the Mediterranean. When the Axis or Allies were ascendant, they were more likely to win sieges, and when the war seemed to go poorly, then both were more likely to lose them. Completing full encirclement also increased the chances of a successful siege. Leningrad survived largely because of the open pathway through Lake Ladoga. The Russian presence on the eastern bank of the Volga made it difficult for the Germans to completely surround Stalingrad. The Germans never reached the eastward perimeter of Moscow. Equally important were the differences in morale, expertise, and willpower. For example, all things being equal, the Japanese probably would have taken Malta, while Italians could have taken neither Singapore nor Corregidor. The democracies rarely talked of defending a city or garrison to the last man. When Churchill hinted of such sacrifice for those trapped at Singapore or Tobruk, no one took him too seriously, as they did similar orders from Hitler, Stalin, and the Japanese militarists. No Russian supreme commander, perhaps, would have been ordered out of an iconic Leningrad or Stalingrad with his family in the manner MacArthur was directed to leave Corregidor. Selecting the proper target counted a great deal. Deft German diplomacy and concessions might have won the Spanish over to a joint attack on Gibraltar, at least before November 1942. Had the Japanese bypassed Singapore and the Philippines and used those assets first to take Pearl Harbor, they would have done far more damage to the American Pacific Fleet and allowed a breathing space to consolidate occupation and exploitation of resource-rich islands. Moscow, not Stalingrad, was the better prize. Who occupied Tobruk was not nearly as important as who occupied Malta, Gibraltar, Alexandria, and Suez. Why we speak of a siege of Malta or Leningrad, but not commonly of a siege of Metz or Aachen, may depend on intangibles, such as the target's relative emblematic status, its special relationship to the battlefield, the tactical and strategic consequences of a siege, when the fighting occurred, and who were the combatants. The war was in the balance at Malta, not so much at Aachen, by October 21, 1944, whose fate was predetermined when the Americans neared the city. The world knew of the iconic cities of Leningrad and Moscow, less so of Metz. The canard in World War II that permanent, fixed, and linear defenses rarely could withstand attack proved largely true. Despite the formidable reputation of the Greater Barrier Walls, all of them were breached, sometimes easily so. The Maginot Line, 1940, the Atlantic Wall, 1944, and the Siegfried Line, 1945, were parachuted over, bypassed, outflanked, or simply plowed through. Had Hitler invested as much thought and expense in taking Stalingrad or Leningrad as he had in building the Atlantic and West Walls, or had the French spent as much on investments in their armored armies as on the Maginot Line, the early course of the war might have turned out somewhat differently. Following World War II, there was once again the expectation in the age of guided missiles and motorized armies that besiegers would no longer attempt to batter their way into strongholds and cities. Yet both successful and failed blockades remained as common as ever, from a surrounded Berlin, 1948 and 1949, that survived, and Bien-Bien-Phu, 1954, that did not, to the unconquerable defenders at Kisan, 1968, Dubrovnik, 1991 and 1992, and Sarajevo, 1992 through 1996. The sieges of World War II remind that while the technologies of the attackers and the attacked had changed from antiquity, their respective aims have always remained the same. Because most government, industry, commerce, military hubs, and transportation are urban enterprises, major cities, especially on the Eastern Front where there were no intervening seas, were natural targets in World War II. Had the Allies captured the major French Atlantic ports intact in June 1944, their armies might have crossed the Rhine by December. Had the Allies held Singapore and Corregidor, the Pacific War would have proceeded very differently. The survival of the Soviet cities of Leningrad and Stalingrad and the British garrison on Malta changed the course of the war. Prior to the 20th century, artillery was mostly stationary, given its size and weight, and the absence of internal combustion engines. Only at sea could ships move large-caliber guns with any speed, largely to be used against other ships. Even after the advent of combat aircraft in World War I, high explosive weapons were limited to bombs and rockets, given that the weight of shells and barrels and the recoil of artillery larger than calibers of 40 millimeters were too great for most fighter and bomber airframes. The armies of World War I, however, had marked a revolution by adapting gasoline engines to chassis with wheels or tracks to move large guns, often cross-country apart from major roads. In the past history of warfare, artillery had been static and with difficulty sought to target mobile infantry. Now guns were moved at speeds as fast or faster than that of foot soldiers. as is noted in Part 5, because artillery by 1939 fired more rapidly with deadlier shells, the combination of a new mobility and deadliness made big guns the most effective weapons of the war. Equally ominous for infantry, improved shelling was not just confined to larger, more mobile guns. At the other end of the spectrum, a new generation of light mortars with ever larger caliber shells meant that there often was no divide between artillery and small arms fire. The World War II foot soldier could become a shooter of both small bullets and large shells. Big guns killed the greatest number of ground troops in a war that was supposed to be mobile and fluid, thereby liberating foot soldiers from the previous nightmares of the trenches and the likely death sentence of constant shelling. Given that reality, it was no surprise that of all the major weapon systems of the war, from ships to airplanes, the belligerents produced more artillery, mortars, and tanks than all other weapons combined. Part 5. Fire. The deadliest guns. The alchemists, in their search for gold, discovered many other things of greater value. Arthur Schopenhauer. 15. Tanks and artillery. From the beginning of civilized warfare, advancing infantry, especially when outnumbered, has dreamed of finding collective protection from missile attacks so that the fewer brave were not slain by the more numerous mediocre. Foot soldiers and horsemen thought it somehow unfair that they might perish beneath anonymous barrages of arrows, bolts, or catapult projectiles fired from afar by their military inferiors. The 4th century BC Spartan king Archidamus III summed up the ancient heroic lament upon first seeing a catapult, "By Heracles, the valor of an individual no longer matters." He anticipated General George S. Patton's moan in Tunisia in March 1943. The general looked from his trench at advancing but unprotected German grenadiers, caught in the crossfire of American artillery, and lamented, "My God, it seems a crime to murder good infantry like that." Prior to the Industrial Age, there were few methods to protect men in the field collectively against the haphazard onslaught of missiles. Heavy chariots were never popular in the wars of the Greek city-states. The terrain of the southern Balkans was too rough. Pasturing ponies in an arid Mediterranean climate often proved too expensive. Usually, no more than two combatants could fit in a war chariot anyway. After Alexander the Great, some of his successors' armies fielded dozens of elephants. They sometimes advanced like living tanks to batter infantry, scatter cavalry, and offer a mobile platform for bowmen. But elephants were costly to import and maintain. They were also difficult to train. Their skins were thick but not quite impenetrable, and their vulnerable orifices and feet were favorite targets. In panic, elephants could wreak as much havoc on their own troops as on the enemy. Roman legionnaires were terrified of mass barrages of missiles, especially when they fought on their eastern fronts against Parthian horse archers. In response to all these challenges, they had long mastered the tactic of testudo, tortoise, a sort of human tank. When archers appeared, legionnaires abruptly formed a veritable shell. A roof and walls of their locked rectangular shields deflected most aerial attacks. Yet the testudo, while occasionally mobile, was mostly a static and temporary defensive mechanism, one hardly analogous to offensive armor. The growing use of gunpowder in the 14th century changed the balance between offense and defense. Projectiles were no longer defined by the limits of muscular strength. Both their size and velocity steadily increased, shattering stone walls in a way even catapults could not. Harquebuses and later musket fire could usually penetrate body armor. Mobile armor, traditional barriers of wood or hides or even metal on wheels that might be sufficiently strong to stand up to missiles, was simply too heavy to be powered by either humans or animals. The science fiction novelist H.G. Wells wrote a 1903 short story about steam-powered armored vehicles, the Land Ironclads. Wells's massive tanks were to lumber across the battlefield, protecting riflemen encased in their armored cabins, from which they would be able to pick off the enemy with impunity. Three breakthroughs brought the tank out of the world of fantasy into the cauldron of World War I. By the latter 19th century, both the machine gun and shrapnel artillery shells gave new advantages to the offense. just a few trained gunners could, in minutes, now slaughter hundreds of unprotected soldiers. That newfound danger had led to renewed demands for new ideas of infantry defense. Second, relatively small, light gasoline-powered internal combustion engines made possible self-powered armor. Gas and diesel engines were an enormous improvement on steam power, and at last allowed land vehicles the same mobility as ships at sea. A third and less appreciated invention was the continuous track. In lieu of wheels, tracks better redistributed the great weight of iron and steel-armored vehicles throughout the entire chassis. Caterpillar tracks opened up otherwise impassable terrain that had punctured tires and clogged axles. Suddenly, self-propelled armored units might follow or even lead almost anywhere that infantry tread. In September 1916, the British first used gasoline-powered primitive tanks at the Battle of the Somme. Despite the general failure of these unreliable prototypes, the tanks administered a shock to the static world of trench warfare. A handful of the strange vehicles made some inroads through German lines in a way previously impossible. Over a year later, at the First Battle of Cambrai, waves of nearly 400 British Mark IV combat tanks broke through German lines on November 20, 1917, before faltering a few days later due to mechanical breakdowns and enemy artillery fire. In the last 2 years of World War I, the Allies built thousands of tanks. The British and the French alone produced almost 8,000 of them, as fighting at last sometimes was unleashed from the trenches. The Germans and Austrians deployed almost none, but armored vehicles were still too mechanically unreliable and slow to change the dynamics of trench war. For the most part, their offensive armament was not commensurate in lethality with artillery, and their armor was not thick enough to deflect most shells. Between the world wars, debate raged over the proper use of the new armor, as tactical theory raced ahead of the technological limitations of tanks. Traditional supporters of infantry wanted tanks in the fashion of armored cars to stay with foot soldiers as support vehicles. They could offer movable shields and mobile machine gun platforms when integrated within the ground advance. In turn, accompanying soldiers could spot landmines and anti-tank ambushes and thereby save the huge investments in armored vehicles. Or perhaps tank men might instead become the ultimate manifestation of romantic mailed knights, autonomously charging through the enemy while safely encased in body armor, but now fueled by gas rather than hay. The cavalry lobby resisted independent motorized armor, just as the wooden and wind-powered warship interests had scoffed at steam-powered ironclads. Nonetheless, in Europe by the 1920s, once any major land power went tank, others had to follow to ensure parity and deterrence, and calls went out to subject armored forces to the same arms limitations sought for ships. The result was that by the eve of World War II, every major power either had armored forces or was scrambling to acquire them. Profits of independent armor formations fell sharply into diverse camps, in the manner of the simultaneous fights in the 1930s over air power and strategic bombing. The new armored visionaries, Generals J.F.C. Fuller, Jean-Baptiste Étienne, Charles de Gaulle, and Heinz Guderian, and Captain B.H. Liddell Hart, envisioned armor replacing heavy cavalry as an independent shock corps. Fast-moving armored divisions in the next war would range far ahead of slower-moving infantry as bullets bounced off their steel hides in a way they most surely did not to the flanks of horses. Tanks would blast holes in enemy lines. Then they would race through or around the enemy's rear. Panic would ensue. Such vast envelopments of enemy armies would lead to moral collapse. Supporting infantry would follow and mop up stunned and surrounded enemies. Armor would not just protect gunners inside as they killed infantry with near impunity. It would instead win entire wars by creating psychological havoc behind the lines to collapse armies through fear and shock, doing to infantry on the battlefield what the contemporary bombers would supposedly do to civilians at home. Tanks would cut through barbed wire, run over foxholes, and with their main guns blast fortifications as their machine guns and cannons swept the battlefield. As with bombers, the tank would always get through. By the early 1930s, tank theorists no longer sounded so unworldly, given the reality that armored vehicles were steadily becoming bigger, faster, and far more reliable than their plodding World War I counterparts. With the advent of the modern fighter plane, the advanced submarine, and the aircraft carrier, the world of Western warfare seemed to have been turned upside down in a way unseen since the 14th century spread of gunpowder. The post-World War I tank was envisioned as an anti-Verdun, anti-Somme weapon. As Patton put it in 1939, the shorter the battle, the fewer men will be killed, and hence the greater their self-confidence and enthusiasm. To produce a short battle, tanks must advance rapidly but not hastily. The pre-war dreams of military strategists in the 1930s hinged on mobile warfare anchored by fleets of fast-moving armored vehicles. Battles would be short, mobile, and decisive, no longer static, fixed, and endless. Smoky, dirty, shell, and bullet-spewing machines were romanticized as a way to deter, or at least shorten, wars of the future. By the end of World War II, the effectiveness of tanks hinged not just on the quality of the machine or crew training, but also on sheer numbers. Just as far larger cavalry forces usually defeated smaller ones, even with less hardy horses and less effective cavalrymen, so too tanks became a decisive force on the World War II battlefield, especially when one side had far more serviceable armored vehicles than did its enemy. Without armor superiority, battle simply was transferred to more expensive and often inconclusive duels between tanks. Thus, the value of tanks was not necessarily their armor per se, or prowess against other tanks, but the ability to be freed against armies that did not field a comparable armored force. Many weapons could stop a rapidly advancing tank. Other tanks, fighter bombers, artillery, handheld anti-tank rockets, or minefields. But ostensibly, the easiest way was for another tank to blow up its counterpart. And when that did not or could not happen, panic among tank crews often ensued. In summer 1941, an invading Panzer regiment became terrified that none of their accustomed weaponry could stop the onslaught of strange new T-34 and KV-1 Soviet tanks. An official German army report chronicled their plight. "The heavy tanks cannot be beaten by our weaponry. The men have almost no ammunition left and are being run down by Russian tanks." The fright of the Panzer crewmen was akin to fears of lesser predators that a lion or tiger was roaming their jungle. On rare occasions, superior tanks simply wiped out their armored enemies without respite. On June 13, 1944, legendary Waffen-SS Panzer Captain Michael Wittmann, a week after D-Day, in perhaps the most celebrated and often mythicized single tank charge in armored history, slammed his small formation of Tiger tanks into units of the British 7th Armored Division at the Battle of Yerbocage. While details of the engagement remain in dispute, apparently when Wittmann's crew and accompanying tanks were through firing the 88mm guns of their Panzerkampfwagen Mark IV Tigers, they may well have destroyed 14 tanks, 15 other armored vehicles, and a few anti-tank guns. Few standard tanks other than the Sherman Firefly in the American and British armored arsenal of mid-1944 could stop a Tiger tank commanded by a skilled veteran of the Eastern Front. Yet for all Wittmann's audacity, for all the marked advantages of his huge Tiger and the elan of German armored units, his daring led nowhere. He soon retreated in the face of Allied reinforcements and air superiority, leaving behind damaged Tigers and without materially altering the pulse of the larger battle. Wittmann, it turned out, had too few tanks. He had brought along too few accompanying soldiers, and there were too few planes of the Luftwaffe overhead and too few supply trucks to ensure him fuel and ammunition. Wittmann was purportedly responsible for an astonishing 138 tank kills before being blown up himself, probably by a Canadian Sherman Firefly, on August 8, 1944. Yet the larger lesson from his virtuoso action was that in armored warfare, the seemingly mundane mattered as much as overt battle elan. When tanks were well supplied with fuel and replacement parts, easily serviceable, present in large numbers, protected by air cover, accompanied by skilled infantry, and supported by covering artillery or anti-tank weapons, then the actual specifications of a tank's armor protection and offensive capability, within parameters, played a lesser role. German panzers, the war's most seasoned armored forces, eventually equipped with the most feared tanks, were nonetheless unable to change the course of any major campaign after 1942. Tanks like ancient elephants or modern battleships were formidable weapons and the stuff of deadly romance, but their achievement ultimately rested more with routine considerations than the impenetrability of their armor, the power of their guns, and the heroics of their crews. When World War II started in 1939, no one quite knew what defined a tank. Peacetime tank field trials, as well as the experience of the Germans, Italians, and Russians in the Spanish Civil War, raised operational controversies well beyond the proper tactics of armored warfare. Such confusion would never really be resolved until nearly the last 2 years of the war. The variables of tank design appeared almost endless. Unfortunately, usually one asset came at the expense of another in a zero-sum trade-off. The thickness and quality of armor were important requisites to ensure that the tank was immune from ground fire, bombing, mines, artillery, or other tanks. But if so, the thick-skinned, huge, weighty, costly, but underpowered and unreliable German Tigers should have been the war's most effective tanks. Tanks were also evaluated by their own offensive power, but there were lots of ways to calibrate the optimum tank gun beyond the diameter of the barrel. Just as important were the barrel length, the quality of its high-grade steel construction, the amount of propellant in the shell, the nature of the projectile, for example, HEAT, high explosive anti-tank, or APDS, armor-piercing discarding sabot, rounds available late in the war, along with other variants, the gun's recoil and sighting systems, the speed of loading, and shell carrying capacity. The problem for gun designers was that the war came upon them so suddenly and without much of a tradition of technological experience that no one quite understood the complex relationship between projectiles, armor, and internal combustion engines. A tank's speed, 20 to 35 miles per hour, and mobility, perhaps epitomized by the well-rounded Russian T-34, were essential to armored success, to entrap the enemy or to escape other tanks. At first, designers were unsure whether tanks should have machine guns and one gun, or, like the French Char and American Lee Grant, two. There was no consensus whether the most effective tank engines were the more common gas-powered power plants. Such engines were certainly more familiar to American mechanics. They usually started more easily in cold weather, and traditionally they had run on a fuel more plentifully refined, though at greater cost, per barrel of oil. In contrast, diesel engines, standard in the T-34 and a few models of the American Sherman, offered more torque per horsepower. Diesel engines were usually also more reliable and longer-lasting, and were not beset with the problems of ignition or gas engine carburetors that so often plague German tanks. They were somewhat less flammable, although 25% of diesel T-34s on the Eastern Front caught fire after being hit, and more fuel-efficient. In this regard, the rate of fuel consumption and the range of the tank, 60 to 150 miles before the need to refuel, were key. As important was less glamorous mechanical reliability, as expressed by the ratio between the hours of tank maintenance needed per hour of actual deployment on the battlefield. In that regard, the much criticized American Sherman was perhaps the most easily maintained and repaired of all tanks, enjoying an extraordinary high percentage of deployed units staying operational. The far fewer produced Panthers or Tigers were more often under repair or out of fuel, diminishing the importance that they could outduel the ubiquitous Shermans. Per unit cost affected all the above criteria, and thus fielding lots of mass-produced good tanks, such as Shermans and T-34s, proved more advantageous than relying on fewer but finely crafted and superb Panthers. Clearly, a single tank could not meet all the desiderata. Yet at the outbreak of the war, it was still debatable whether it was wiser to produce different models for different tasks, such as light, medium, and heavy tanks, or to focus on a generic multitask tank and produce it in the thousands with standardized parts and maintenance regimes. Ironically, Germany's war against mostly ill-prepared European neighbors had started with a simple premise of quantity over quality. Lots of light, vulnerable tanks such as Panzer Mark I's and II's were apparently preferable to having a few with superior characteristics comparable, for example, to the heavy French Char B1. But as the war progressed beyond Denmark, Norway, Poland, and France, and as the Third Reich met the Russians and British, the pace of the evolution of armored fighting vehicles was soon taking on a life of its own. The German Mark I tankettes, 9, less than 6 tons, 2 light machine guns, and less than an inch of armor, that rolled into Poland in September 1939, bore little resemblance to the so-called Tiger IIs, King Tiger, the huge monstrosities that appeared just 4 years later, 70 tons, an 88-millimeter cannon, and up to 7 inches of armor. In between the two models were hundreds of thousands of dead tankers and their victims, from whose fatal lessons would finally emerge a rough consensus at war's end as to the properly designed tank. If the war had broken out with little affinity among French, British, German, Russian, or American tanks, some with cannon, some not, some with small guns, others with large, some with one, multiple or no turrets, some with wide, some with narrow treads, some gas-powered, some diesel, by the end of the war, everyone's ideal tank, oddly, looked about the same. The Americans who reviewed the shortcomings of their ubiquitous Sherman thought they knew exactly what was needed in an improved tank by 1945. As the commander of the 2nd Armored Division, Major General Ernest H. Harmon, put it in 1945, first, gunpowder, second, battlefield maneuverability, third, as much armor protection as can be had after meeting the first two requirements, still staying within a weight that can be gotten across obstacles with our bridge equipment. That archetypal tank by 1945 was expressed in various ways by the upgraded Russian T-34, the German Panther, the American Pershing, and the British Comet. The apparent common minimum denominators were weights over 30 tons but less than 50, a long barrel, high-velocity cannon of between 76 millimeters and 90 millimeters, relatively low silhouettes and cast turrets, wide tracks, and sloped armor of about 100 millimeters thickness or over. Indeed, 70 years after World War II and despite revolutions in armor and armament, a 21st century T-90 Russian tank or an American M1 Abrams does not look all that much different from a German Panther, while in contrast, a 1945 vintage P-51 Mustang bears little resemblance to a 21st century F-22 Raptor. Once the war began, universal tank design soon reflected two realities. One, for both Allied and Axis designers, it was hard to discover and quickly collate common experiences in various theaters from outside Moscow to Libya to find an optimum consensus. The Americans, for example, had little idea that their new and much-heralded Shermans that often reigned supreme in autumn 1942 in North Africa, largely due to the fact that many German panzers before mid-1942 were still not yet upgunned beyond 50 millimeters, were already outdated, given the knowledge learned from the Russian front. Two, long-held practices and national attitudes about industrial production and technological design sometimes warped practical, empirical decisions. Germans sought craftsmanship and size, Americans reliability and practicality, Russians mass production, and the British specialization. Consequently, distillation of diverse lessons from the battlefield, especially on the Eastern Front in late 1941 and 1942, took about 2 years. Armor designers, unfortunately, often ignored the uncomfortable conditions of battle inside a tank. None were more uncomfortable than the superb Russian T-34. Yet a cramped and poorly designed interior, along with accompanying operator fatigue, were intangibles that could affect overall armor efficiency. Tanks were, after all, designed to protect soldiers from machine guns and artillery shells, while spitting out both to devastate unprotected infantry. If they were too crowded, for example, too many soldiers in the turret posed problems in early American tanks, their interior air noxious, particularly in early tank designs, the interior quarters poorly laid out, the engines unreliable, designs from the 1930s had insufficient horsepower, the tracks prone to premature wear and the fuel consumption excessive, then crew performance suffered to the point of rendering good armor and offensive punch less relevant. It proved almost impossible to square the circle of ensuring crew safety and comfort when trapped in a riveted or welded steel shell of stored gasoline, high explosive shells and machine gun bullets, sparking engine plugs and incoming projectiles. Tank fleets were not always worth the enormous investment in strategic materials and production costs that often came at the expense of ship, plane, and small arms output. Artillery and armor brought little advantage to the battlefield if these weapons were easily neutralized by cheaper handheld anti-tank guns, mines, tank-destroying artillery, fighter bombers, and even other and especially more cheaply produced tanks. The key, as in the use of air and sea power, was to ensure that armor was liberated to collapse or destroy vulnerable infantry and fixed positions. The Germans had proved that fact in their serial border wars between 1939 and 1940, when even poorly designed early panzers were not seriously checked by either opposing tanks or artillery, and therefore rolled over enemy resistance. Armor superiority determined the cost-to-benefit worth of tanks, and even a tankette could win a battle if unopposed by enemy armor. Given poor French morale, it brought the French little advantage that their advanced heavy Char B1 tanks on paper were superior to any armored vehicle that the Germans brought into France in May and June 1940. In addition, the French were reluctant to form independent offensive armored formations and did not coordinate their fuel-hungry French tanks with fleets of refueling trucks. French tanks, like French fighter planes, might be better than their German counterparts, but French armored forces, again like French air forces, were usually worse, given their organizational, operational, and morale problems. The German Blitzkrieg of September 1939 and the invasion of France, May through June 1940, proved the antitheses to the later static tank duels on the Eastern Front from 1943 to 1945, where German and Russian tanks ground one another down without being unleashed on infantry. The key was mobility and the ability to hit exposed infantry, or as General Rommel put it about the great armored thrusts of the North African campaigns, against a motorized and armored enemy, non-motorized infantry divisions are of value only in prepared positions. Once such positions have been pierced or outflanked, and they are forced to retreat from them, they become helpless victims of the motorized enemy. In extreme cases, they can do no more than hold on in their positions to the last round. In contrast, when tanks blasted apart tanks or were destroyed by foot soldiers before attacking infantry, or found themselves mired in impassable terrain, manpower and capital devoted to armor simply proved a lost expense. At the epic tank battle of Kursk, Operation Citadel, July 5th through the 16th, 1943, both the Russians and Germans deployed quality tanks to prevent their enemy from slicing through infantry. But given that superior Russian numbers were matched by German marginal quality and training advantages, the two armored forces neutralized each other without either side achieving a breakout. The Russians suffered three times as many casualties and 7 to 10 times the number of tank losses, yet they still ensured both a tactical and strategic German defeat, a fact that might suggest numbers rather than the quality of Russian tanks and the training of the crews were pivotal. Of the masses of Russian infantry and armor at Kursk, a despairing panzer crewman thought Russian tanks were scurrying like rats all over the battlefield. General Erhard Raus saw the armored stalemate at Kursk as the turning point of the entire Eastern Front. Victory was once again in the offing, but it turned out to be a Russian one. Our 11 panzer divisions, reconstituted during a lull lasting 3 months, could not come to grips with the Red Army's reserves to annihilate them because Hitler threw all of the German armor into Operation Citadel in July 1943 and bled it white upon running into a fortified system of hitherto unknown strength and depth. Hitler thereby fulfilled Stalin's keenest hopes and presented him with the palm of victory. Kursk proved to be Germany's Pyrrhic Battle of Heraclea, 280 BC, or Asculum, 279 BC, when Greek invaders won battles in Italy only by suffering losses and erosion of morale that would preclude ultimate strategic victory. Generals Model and Manstein, to paraphrase Pyrrhus's lament of Asculum's strategic consequences, might have sighed, "If we prove victorious in one more such battle with the Russians, we shall be utterly ruined." There was nothing in the immediate German past to suggest that the Nazi government would produce the most lethal tanks by the end of World War II, at least as narrowly defined by their superiority in tank-on-tank battles. Germany had produced just a handful of its clumsy A7V tanks in World War I. In 1939 and 1940, German tankers startled the world with blitzkrieg victories due not to superior tanks but to their better training, unit cohesion, officer corps, and morale. On the Eastern Front, their inferior German tanks achieved impressive kill ratios over clearly more lethal Russian T-34s and continued to do against the late and vastly improved Russian models of 1944 and 1945. However well-trained the crews, however visionary the officers, however great the global reputation of Blitzkrieg, the vast majority of early German and Czech tanks before 1942 nonetheless were no better and often worse than Russian, American, and British designs. The thinly armored PZKPFW-1, approximately 1500 built, tankette, had no main battle gun and was originally designed as a trainer. Its replacement, the PZKPFW-2, approximately 1900 built, was initially outfitted with only a light 20mm gun of the sort used for anti-aircraft duty. Even the pre-war American M2 light tank, obsolete when the war began, was outfitted with a much larger 37mm main gun. The envisioned successor to the PZKPFW-2, the PZKPFW-3, was slated to become the backbone of the new armored corps, some 5,700 built. But even its updated gun, a longer-barrel high-velocity 50mm that replaced the original 37mm, did not ensure superiority over most Allied tanks of the time. There was no valid reason by late 1941 to believe German armor should have proven the terror of the European continent. Blitzkrieg played on the myth of German technological superiority and industrial dominance. But the successes of early panzer divisions were instead predicated on the poor preparation and morale of Germany's enemies. The PZKPFW-1s and 2s, Stuka dive bombers, and horse-drawn artillery and transport were formidable only against European border enemies whose militaries were not battle-ready, such as those of Poland, Denmark, Norway, Belgium, Luxembourg, France, Yugoslavia, and Greece. Some of the German generals were aware of their panzer mirage. As early as mid-1940, veterans of armored encounters were warning Hitler's staff that the Wehrmacht was in no shape to invade any country that possessed tanks comparable to their panzers and air support. One of the most inexplicable facts of World War II was the chronic poor quality of German tanks that entered Russia in 1941, almost 22 months after the war had begun. Not only were the panzers, over 50% of them obsolete Mark 1s and 2s and Czech models, little better than most of their Russian counterparts and often quite inferior to growing numbers of T-34s and KV-1s, but they also were outnumbered. This lapse and the utter German failure to acknowledge it prior to the invasion was astonishing, given that the success of Operation Barbarossa was predicated on rapid armored assaults achieving a shock-and-awe victory within a few weeks, in the fashion of those earlier triumphs of 1939 and 1940. German tank inferiority in 1941 and 1942 did not necessarily mean that the largest armored invasion in history was doomed, but it did ensure that there would be no quick collapse of Russia. Hitler reportedly understood the Wehrmacht's dilemma. He supposedly remarked to General Heinz Guderian at Army Group Headquarters on August 4, 1941, "If I had known that the figures for Russian tank strength which you gave in your book were in fact the true ones, I would not, I believe, ever have started this war." It was a stunning admission that the single issue of tanks had altered the entire course of World War II. Hitler had just sent almost 4 million Axis troops against a former ally in hopes of a quick victory spearheaded by tanks, but without any appreciation of the quantity, quality, or production capacity of his new enemy's armored forces, information that was known to his generals as early as 1937. Guderian, infamous for his post-facto self-serving revisionism, nonetheless may be right that he had estimated Russian tank strength at that time as 10,000. Both the chief of the Army General Staff, Beck, and the censor had disagreed with his statement. It had cost me a lot of trouble to get that figure printed, but I had been able to show that intelligence reports at the time spoke of 17,000 Russian tanks, and that my estimate was therefore, if anything, a very conservative one. Only with the updated later models of the PZKPFW-4 did Germany first produce a good tank in respectable numbers, approximately 9,000. With sloping armor and a reliable engine, the PZKPFW-4 would eventually become the most widely produced German tank of the war, a workhorse continually updated with increased armor and a more powerful gun. Yet when even a few of the improved PZKPFW-4s entered Russia in the first German waves of Operation Barbarossa, their crews were still astounded at how an otherwise poorly organized and deployed enemy matched up evenly, and how hard it was for Germans to knock out even the small numbers of new T-34s with the PZKPFW-4's still underpowered gun. One veteran anti-tank battery crewman's recollection of first meeting a T-34 proved surreal. Half a dozen anti-tank gun shells fire at him, which sound like a drum roll, but he drives staunchly through our line like an impregnable prehistoric monster. In a December 1941 shootout with T-34s, a German tanker said of the effect of his 50mm gun on Russian tanks, "But there was no visible effect. Damn pea-shooter." The fright of German panzer crews at unaccustomed Russian weapons was a trope throughout the history of warfare. It was felt just as much by Philip V's confident Macedonian cavalry, who, on first encountering the lethal swordplay of Roman horsemen, were shocked at the carnage that a Spanish gladius might inflict on supposedly invincible troops such as themselves. For men who had seen the wounds dealt by javelins and arrows and occasionally by lances, since they were used to fighting with the Greeks and Illyrians, when they had seen bodies chopped to pieces by the Spanish sword, arms torn away, shoulders and all, or heads separated from bodies, with the necks completely severed, or vitals laid open, and other fearful wounds, realized in a general panic with what weapons and what men they had to fight. Official reports from the Russian front as early as a few weeks into the invasion suggested similar widespread panic on the part of German crews when confronted by superior Russian tanks. Time and again our tanks have been split right open by hits from the front, and the commander's cupolas on the Type 3 and 4 tanks have been completely blown off. The former pace and spirit of the attack will die down and will be replaced by a feeling of inferiority, since the crews know that they can be knocked out by enemy tanks while they are still a great distance away. Note again that Type 3 and 4 tanks, Mark 3s and Mark 4s, were the best models of German tanks that entered Russia. Over half the panzer fleet was far worse. As a result, many German officers by late 1941 hoped the German industry might in desperation quickly reverse engineer or outright copy T-34s to produce them in similar numbers. But the obstacles to duplicating the T-34 were not only German pride in engineering. Guderian, an original German architect of Panzer doctrine and later Inspector General of Armored Troops, claimed, probably correctly, that by 1942 and 1943, Germany lacked enough strategic materials, especially bauxite, to copy the T-34 aluminum diesel engine and high-quality steel armor. It may be a damning concession that in the very first months of Operation Barbarossa, a gamble predicated on armor dashes, the Third Reich's tanks were not only inferior to Russian T-34s, but the German industry did not have the wherewithal to copy superior enemy models in sufficient numbers. A tank race followed that ultimately reached absurd lengths. The shock of the T-34 also suggested that there might be further Russian surprises on the horizon. Russian armored production also now brought into doubt the entire ideological premises for invading Russia in the first place, to take Russian territory from inferior and backward peoples and to give it to those more technologically sophisticated who, by their intellectual superiority, deserved it. Hitler failed to grasp that the antidotes to the T-34 and to the heavier Russian KV-1 were not just to be found in thicker armor and bigger guns, although he would eventually accomplish both those traits with the deployment of the Tiger, the so-called King Tiger, and the more versatile Panther. To thwart Russian armor, prototypes of improved German heavy tanks were suddenly rushed into production, most famously the Panzerkampfwagen 6 Tiger. A few of the so-called Tiger I's appeared in August 1942. They usually handled with ease the offensive and defensive challenges of the early models of the T-34. Equipped with a 700-horsepower engine, a vastly superior 88mm main gun, and up to 5 inches of sloped armor, the early Tiger models had good odds of destroying Russian tanks at ranges of well over a mile. And at that distance, it was largely immune from penetrating counterfire. But the Tiger's record weight, almost 60 tons, size 20 feet long and over 12 feet wide, and cost over twice that of an updated PZKPFW-4, often nullified what advantages it offered over the T-34. In contrast, the T-34's success came from the Russian ability to produce it in enormous numbers while ensuring that it remained mostly reliable and continually upgraded. As a general rule, then, the answer to strapped German industry by late 1942 was not to produce a few good weapons, but plentiful, adequate ones. Gigantism, the psychological disorder that even bigger is always better, had been, historically, a bane of military technology, from Demetrius the Besieger's outlandish Heliopolis siege engine to the Japanese super-battleships Yamato and Musashi, that likewise led to a colossal waste of men and material, and yet were scheduled to be superseded by a super-Yamato of 90,000 tons with 20-inch guns. Hitler suffered especially from the disease that seems to infect autocrats with a special vengeance. Tigers were too large for many bridges and roads, and wore out their tracks and transmissions quickly. They were expensive to transport. They gulped fuel at record rates. They were costly and time-consuming to produce, built to exacting specifications, required extensive training to operate and maintain, and ultimately were produced in too few numbers, 1350, to make much difference on the Eastern Front, despite their feared reputation among enemy tank crews. Most important, they took over 10 times as many man-hours of labor to produce as American or Russian medium tanks. Nonetheless, German gigantism continued with the upgraded Tiger II, or so-called King or Royal Tiger, an impractical monstrosity 10 tons heavier than its predecessor, 4 feet longer, and with 2 inches of additional armor. Yet if Tiger IIs were the deadliest tanks in World War II, they were also rare on the battlefield, given that fewer than 500 were produced. The fetishes of German tank design with regards to firepower and armor led to even more absurdities. Prototypes of the so-called Mouse Tank, PZKPFW-8, were to reach 33 feet long and 200 tons in weight, armed with a 128mm cannon, and protected by over 10 inches of armor in places. They were similar in spirit to the huge Krupp railguns and V-weapons that might have been technologically impressive, but otherwise proved a poor investment in terms of cost-benefit ratios of delivering effective explosives to the enemy. The Panther was a far better answer to the T-34 than the huge Tigers. The Panther was heavier, 45 tons, than the T-34, and better armed, a lethal, long-barreled, high-velocity 75mm gun, and armored over 4 inches on average. Its re-engineered transmission finally proved far more reliable. The quality of its steel construction was superior. Yet the Panther was not as unwieldy, underpowered, or inordinately expensive as the Tiger, which is not to say it was ever reliable or as easily maintained as the American Sherman. Still, its sudden appearance in summer 1943 raised the question of why the Nazi hierarchy had not rushed something like it into production by mid-1941 to coincide with a vast invasion predicated on superior armor. Initial reliability problems led Hitler at first to compare the Panther to the innovative but problem-plagued Heinkel 177 heavy bomber. The Panther is the crawling Heinkel. But the Panthers, in the last 2 years of the war, were considered by armored commanders on both fronts as the best all-around tank. Perhaps had Hitler waited to invade the Soviet Union until 1943, and had he not been under Allied bombing attack, with the final combined production numbers of 17,000 PZKPFW-4s, Tigers and Panthers, then his own strategic blunders might not have so quickly nullified the excellence of his soldiers and officers. Germany was faced with an enemy alliance that was capable of producing nearly 250,000 tanks in American, British, and Russian factories, 5 times the eventual total German output. Russia was able to move much of its entire tank industry eastward. The Third Reich was never fully able to exploit operating tank factories in France and Czechoslovakia in occupied Europe to maximize German output. The solution to that problem on a multitude of fronts was perhaps not 6,000 Panthers, but in theaters from Anzio and Normandy to the Crimea, either to field 50,000 Panthers and PZKPFW-4s, or a corresponding enormous production of 88mm anti-tank guns and fighter bombers. What best illustrated the ultimate fate of the German panzers was that by 1944 there were no longer proper panzer divisions at all, with each division having only 1 or 2 tank battalions of well fewer than 90 tanks each, while American armored divisions typically deployed 3 battalions of anywhere from 200 to 300 tanks each. After the war, the Nazi production minister Albert Speer claimed that he had sought both to simplify and expand tank production to match the Allies. For all his later myth-making and contradictory recollections, he probably did cut out duplication, end waste, and focus on fewer models of weaponry, so much so that even after the bombing of 1944 and 1945, by war's end, Speer was producing four times the number of weapons from each ton of raw steel that Germany had managed in 1941. Nonetheless, by 1944, even Speer's efforts were too late, given shortages of strategic materials. Hitler's ingrained interference in industrial policy, labor shortages, damage from Allied bombing, and fuel disruptions. Germany ended the war with a relatively small number of excellent tanks after beginning it with a relatively large number of mediocre ones. The one constant to German panzer forces over 44 continual months of fighting was not quality tanks, but superior crews, who achieved astounding kill ratios over the tanks of all their enemies. An impressive, but in the end, irrelevant achievement. A mystique about Russian tanks inspired awe on the Germans, who were forced to confront them, and among the Russians themselves, who rightly equated tanks with their national salvation. Some Russian couples wrote to officials offering to use their own money to buy a tank so that they could operate it in tandem. Indeed, one Russian patriot, Alexandra Koitos, commanded a huge 45-ton IS-2 Stalin tank with her husband serving as mechanic, and they fought through the Baltic states all the way to Berlin. It was not just Soviet propaganda that made claims that Russian heavy tanks were vastly superior to German models. Until 1943, German officers had wholeheartedly agreed. From Hitler on down, there was praise from the German high command for the T-34. First Panzer Army General Paul von Kleist summed up the early T-34s that he had encountered with a simple declaration: "It should be clear to us that the infantry at this time runs away from every Russian tank because they have no defense against them." Part of the problem in initially assessing the T-34 was that Western powers, both Allies and Axis, knew very little about Stalin's military capabilities. Most of what was written about Soviet industry in general proved to be untrue, emblemized perhaps by the writings of the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the New York Times, Walter Duranty, who falsely reported about the successes of the Soviet state in the 1930s. But along with misinformation about these starvations, show trials, and purges, Westerners and the Japanese also vastly underappreciated the extent of the Russian pre-war arms buildup. Even if they were to grant that Soviet factories could turn out lots of munitions, they could not yet conceive that the finished products were comparable to Western quality. The initial and problem-plagued models of the T-34s nevertheless shocked the Germans, not unlike the manner in which unfamiliar Parthian-mounted archers flummoxed supposedly superior Roman Republican legions in the east, or the massed ranks of longbowmen stunned the French crossbowers at the Battle of Crécy, 1346, or improvised explosive devices had stymied Americans in Iraq when such mines began shredding thin-skinned Humvee transport vehicles. General Guderian best summed up German confusion: "We believed at the beginning of the new war we could reckon on our tanks being technically better than all known Russian types. We thought this would more or less cancel out the Russians' vast numerical superiority." Such arrogance was bolstered by successes of German armor so far, despite the demonstrable inferiority of Panzer Mark 1s, 2s, and 3s. German armored divisions had lost only 1-2% of their crews to enemy action, and seen only 2-3% of their early model light tanks destroyed in the conquest of Poland, in addition to numerous damaged and worn-out tanks, and later, despite heavier losses in the West, had easily found ways to counter some of the heavier, better-armed and armored French tanks. The lesson from France was that superior morale and training allowed German tankers to ignore the quality of enemy armor. But in fact, the Russians had at least as much experience in tank battle as had the Germans prior to Operation Barbarossa. The Soviet border fighting with Japan, 1938 and 1939, and against Finland, 1939 and 1940, fought in diverse landscapes and climates, had taught the Russians more about the limitations of undergunned and under-armored light tanks than the Germans had learned in the relatively rapid and easy Blitzkrieg victories over Poland and Western Europe. The new Russian T-34 tank that reached widespread production by late 1942 reflected a decade of adapting imported German, British, and American suspensions, engines, and armament technology, and was constructed on American principles of mass production using simple designs that were of moderate cost, easy to operate, and simple to maintain. After only a few weeks in Russia, German tank crews were already meeting some of the nearly 1,000 newly produced T-34s, and the experience made them almost immediately shed all the confidence gained against mostly outnumbered and inadequate European tanks in 1939 and 1940. One Panzer Regimental Commander, Hermann Bix, noted in an October entry in his diary, "And then we saw something that we heretofore would not have considered possible. We saw our tanks pull back by the company, turn around, and then make haste to disappear over the high ground." The T-34's strengths were manifest in a variety of characteristics. Its lighter aluminum diesel engine was often less likely to ignite when hit than the otherwise dependable gasoline engine in the German PZKPFW-4 tank. It offered a good degree of power for its weight. A high-velocity 76.2mm gun was better than the PZKPFW-4's 50mm cannon, and, in fact, perhaps superior to almost any 75mm or 76mm tank gun in the world in 1941 and 1942. The Russian tank's sloped armor and wider tracks meant that it was both less vulnerable and more mobile than the Mark series German tanks that entered Russia's decrepit road system in June 1941, if not also more cramped and sometimes dangerous for crews. Most important, by focusing on just a few models and eventually moving most tank production out of harm's way beyond the Ural Mountains, by the end of 1942, the Soviet Union was exceeding German tank production and yet was deploying tanks, at least until the arrival of Tigers and Panthers, of comparable and often superior quality. Despite poor tactics and inexperience, Russian armored forces were able to hold off German panzer forces by early 1943 at Stalingrad and began to grind them down 6 months later at Kursk. For all its clumsiness, limited production, and inexperienced crews, the even heavier KV-1 Kliment Voroshilov tank, 45 tons, 90 millimeters of armor, a 76-millimeter main gun, and a 550-horsepower engine, outclassed any heavy German tank until the appearance of the Tiger in late 1942. A Panzer Brigade commander, Heinrich Eberbach, summed up the typical German reaction at meeting a few KV-1s in January 1942. "Our tanks encountered a Russian tank brigade which was exclusively outfitted with heavy tanks, T-34s and KV-1s. The steel giants were overwhelmingly superior to our Panzer IIIs and Panzer IVs. I had to give my soldiers, who were accustomed to victory, the order to pull back twice in order to avoid being destroyed." On average, the Germans destroyed somewhere between 3 and 7 T-34s for each German tank lost. Yet the successful deployment of armored forces rarely rests on the premise of tank versus tank battles, or Panzer aces, however dramatic and deadly particular tank crews could be. If such principles won armored battles, the Germans would have knocked out Soviet armor by the third year of the war. Indeed, in any given one-on-one tank battle by mid-1943, the initial models of the T-34 proved mostly inferior to both the Tiger and Panther, and perhaps no better than the late model and updated PZKPFW-4, or for that matter, later models of the American Sherman, especially the ingeniously adapted Firefly. Its optics were mediocre and accuracy questionable. The 76mm gun itself was large enough with good velocity, but was surpassed in size by the Tiger and in quality by the Panther. The two-man turret of the T-34 ensured slowness in aiming and firing. Most early models lacked reliable radios. The advanced design of the sloped armor also meant reduced space for crews and poor visibility. Early T-34 engines were powerful for their weight, but had a short life and were plagued by poor air filters. Despite the parity of late model T-34s and the superiority of heavy Stalin IS-2s, German Panther tank crews on average tended to be more highly trained and skilled even late into the war. In March 1945, in a not unusual tank battle, two Panthers near Danzig wiped out an entire column of Russian heavy tanks. During the 3 days of fighting, 21 heavy and super-heavy enemy tanks were destroyed by German panzers without a single loss. By late 1942, T-34s were more vulnerable to updated German wheeled and handheld anti-tank guns than were German tanks to Russian counterparts, especially because German handheld Panzerfausts and Panzerschrecks were the most effective handheld anti-tank recoilless rifles and rocket launchers of the war. The Soviets deployed an astonishing 400,000 tank crewmen in World War II. Perhaps 300,000 perished, an eerie testament to German skilled air, artillery, and tank crews. Yet Russian tank forces grew each year of the war, analogous to the increase of the U.S. Merchant Marine Fleet, which expanded in size even in the depressing months of 1942 as U-boat kills reached all-time highs. Accept two paradoxes, and then the controversies over the American M4 Sherman tank's effectiveness become somewhat irrelevant, or rather, emblematic of the entire American approach to total war. First, when Shermans initially appeared in 1942 and early 1943 in North Africa and Sicily, they were perhaps the best tanks in the West. Yet by the time Shermans were deployed in the thousands in 1944 and 1945 in Italy and Western Europe, they were clearly inferior to most German models, with traumatic psychological effects on the entire American armor corps. Typical was the experience of Sherman tanker Corporal Patrick Hennessy, who watched his tank round bounce off a Tiger tank. "I thought, to hell with this," and pulled back. Another Sherman tanker noted, "The Sherman was a very effective workhorse, but as a fighting tank, it was a disaster." Second, Shermans in American rather than British sectors did not often encounter superior German Tiger and Panther models in tank-to-tank battles, and they outnumbered German medium and heavy tanks in Western Europe by ratios of about 10-1 by late 1944. Later accounts of British and American analysts found that the great killers of Sherman tanks were not